episode of What You Doin' Podcast, the interview podcast where I talk to cool people about the amazing things they're working on. My name is Matt. This time I'm sitting down with Chris Falco from Far Horizon Cooperative to talk about their new book, Far Horizon's Guide to Mysterious Locations. This was a really fun interview because I was aware of Far Horizon's co-op as, I don't want to say a brand, but as a group, as a publishing effort. And in doing research for the interview, I actually discovered that they've worked on a lot more than I'd even known. So that's always fun. It's always fun to discover new things, discover new projects to check out, new games, all that. Far Horizon's Guide to Mysterious Locations is currently live on Kickstarter. So as always, the link will be in the show notes. So go ahead, check that out. But enough out of me. Let's get on with the interview. Hey, everybody. Welcome to What You Doin' Podcast, the new podcast where I talk to cool people about the amazing things that they're working on. My name is Matt. Today, I'm sitting down with Chris. Chris, say hello.
Hi. I'm Chris. He, they pronouns. I'm the lead of one of the leads of Far Horizon's co-op, and I have my own publishing group under Falconian Productions. But, you know, today I'm here as a member of Far Horizons.
It was really exciting picking through, looking, you know, clicking all of the things of like, okay, here's all of the Far Horizon stuff. Here's all the stuff that Chris has worked on. Here's all, you know, and finding all of the interesting ways that those webs weave together.
Yeah. It's actually really great because, you know, having your own name to publish under, you know, means you can do whatever the heck you want. But having the co-op means you also have a support structure so you can, like, work on other people's projects and not have it always fall around you. Mm-hmm. Bad example in this case because I'm the lead of the project and thus in charge of herding the cats, but you know.
and you know, a great way to bring us back, the thing I missed at the beginning. So we're here to talk about the new Far Horizons co-op book, Guide to Mysterious Locations, which looks fantastic. I spent a little bit looking over the Kickstarter and the preview document and all of that. And it was very excited to see Marks talk about it on Blue Sky. I've been very lucky on the last month or so of people just kind of saying on Blue Sky, does anyone want to have me on a podcast to talk about this thing? And I'm just like, great, yes, cool.
Marks has been great about it, just to say, like, you know, obviously I've been doing everything I can to get it out there as the lead, but Marks is amazing at just getting out there for any co-op project and trying to, you know, help get it done, help get it out there, help get it known. Mm-hmm. The Guide to Mysterious Locations is our current project. So the Guide to Mysterious Locations is part of what we call our, you know, Far Horizons guides. It started with actually originally called the Role Player's Guide to Heists, which was a big book of exactly that, heists. You know, big setups of like, this is the thing you're getting. This is what everyone can do to prepare for it. This is everything that's going to go wrong or can go wrong, obviously. And it was built around that. We had a bunch of them by different people. And then from that, we went to the Far Horizons Guide to Cults. And that worked along the lines of basically setting up cults that could exist in various different settings and, you know, story hooks, the people involved in them. Of course, you know, art about, you know, to let you visualize what's going on with it. And then our most recent one that is in the Kickstarter, Mysterious Locations, is exactly what it sounds like. This one's more, you know, places you can put into just about any setting. That's the thing. They're all setting and system agnostic. So while a lot of them have, like, you know, this is clearly better suited to a fantasy, in just about everyone that's seemingly specific, we have sidebars about, like, okay, how can you tweak this to put it in something else entirely? How can this thing that looks like, you know, it must belong in cyberpunk internet involve, like, a fantasy dreamscape or something, or vice versa? And so, you know, the idea is anyone can purchase these books, anyone can, you know, slot them into just about any game that's more complicated than, like, you know, representing eating candy at a table or something. That is a specific example, not me just making something up. The idea for the Kickstarter is to make that, you know, get that funded, get everyone paid for it, and if we can get far enough to expand it and make it bigger, because, you know, this one's a little smaller than the previous ones just because of the current state of the industry, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's been, I forget who I said this to. I don't know if it was on the podcast or social media or whatever, but I was like, the way that things have progressed so much since, even just since I started the show, you know, essentially last year, it has been, as I always like to say, like, as a person outside looking in, it seems very fraught. And so I can only imagine, you know, how everybody who's, you know, whose livelihoods are wrapped up in it, who sees the dollars and cents, who sees everything happening in a real granular scale. I don't know. I feel like in part, in an odd way, I feel like I started the show at the right time, because I feel like, you know, the purpose of the show is to get, is that give people a platform to talk about their stuff and hopefully reach new people and kind of use this as a springboard. And it's like, oh, did I accidentally started at the best time, because God, do a lot of people need the opportunity to market their stuff.
Absolutely.
In the way that I hate to think about it. Oh, this worked out.
Yeah. Just kind of the nature of things right now, nature of the world, nature of, like, you know, the tabletop industry tends to be the last thing people spend their dwindling money on. But, you know, so we got to just make our things that much better to make up for it.
Let's talk about sort of some basic overview stuff. So Far Horizons Co-op is a name I'm passingly familiar with. I think people who listen to the show might be familiar with Outliers. I definitely was looking through, I was familiar with Brinkwood. But I think people, me at least, I didn't really tie these back to the sort of same production group. So why don't you tell us about Far Horizons, you know, what's the idea? And cause it's very particular that it's called Far Horizons Co-op, you know, it's not Far Horizons Productions.
Right. It's called co-op for a very good reason. It is set up as a co-op. It is, you know, a commune, as a publishing group. We have, like, dozens of people involved, and some are more involved than others, and that's okay. That's good. Everyone has a vote. We make decisions based on, like, you know, putting forth projects, and you vote on them, and, you know, we see how we can change them and make sure it's the best it can be based on everyone's input. And then we do have project leads, because obviously once you get into the individual project, someone has to make sure it's moving forward. You know, as I implied earlier, I'm one of the leads. I'm usually one of the leads at any given time, because I'm usually trying to get something done in the group. You know, Marx is one of the leads. They handle a lot of things involving the, you know, sites we publish on, things like that. They talk with IPR and obviously they go about doing whatever they can. We have a few other, like, Dire Rose handles money behind the scenes and a few of our other accounts. So, you know, we have a few people who are pretty consistently leads, just because we need to have some people who can handle the important things. But ultimately things come down to a vote. If someone, you know, theoretically messes up, they could be voted out, and that's just how it works. No one has absolute control over the place. So the idea is, you know, give everyone a voice. No one is lording over everyone else and taking 99% of the profits and paying people, you know, 4 cents a word, like certain publishing groups are these days.
Yeah, you know, certain people. We wouldn't name names, but
right. I don't want to go down that path.
Oh, no, I've said multiple times, this podcast is not about trashing D&D, but if it happens, it happens. You know, if we get around to it, it happens, but it's never the intention. So, like you said, having semi-consistent leads makes sense, especially for stuff like finances. You know, you want continuity of knowledge. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, like I've actually been there since the beginning, like since our first project, the Short Games Digest issue one. I was part of that.
I actually realized I own all of those, I think because of a bundle of holding a year or so ago, which was really exciting. I didn't realize how massive those were until, again, I was looking through like all of the titles on like Drive-Thru and Itch and stuff. I didn't realize how massive those were.
Yeah, I guess we need to make our logo a little bigger.
Well, and I think this gets to a really interesting thing with I guess like it's a thing I've been thinking about a little bit recently with this the idea of like legacy sales and the difficulty of, you know, especially now, but I feel like it's kind of always a problem of keeping things in print, keeping things in stock, keeping things turning over, you know, for, you know, well, here, instead of it taking something that it sounds like and making a question off of that, how does Far Horizon generally operate in terms of like print products and production?
That tends to depend on the project. Most of our projects, we do the like PDF and print on demand route because that is, you know, minimally impactful on us. Mm-hmm. But our larger projects like Outliers got a, you know, had a decent Kickstarter, and Brinkwood had a decent Kickstarter. So both of them had a actual print run. And then when, you know, when we have actual print runs, we send the actual prints to like IPR. And anywhere else we can get them sold. Mm-hmm. Smaller projects tend to live on Drive-Thru and the like, but sometimes we can get the print on demands of those, you know, sold off to stores too. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, we're always happy to do. Obviously everyone shares the funds from that too.
Yeah, it seems like such an interesting struggle for even for even a more traditional publishing house to have this sort of constant baggage of product. It's a thing I thought about a lot about, you know, when I was running stuff in stores and working directly with store owners, of just this idea of the constant dance of what do you bring in? What do you have? What do you try to push and all of this? And then I imagine it's very similar scale for, you know, it's, I imagine it's almost the exact same problem, just at a different level for a publishing company of, okay, we, you know, we want to sell all of these. How many of these should we buy? How many, you know, and it's just a massive financial risk to take on, to say nothing of the physical space required for it.
Right. That's the thing. Like, we have a few people who are actually near like printing places. They can get it handled themselves. So they can get pretty comparatively at least cheap printing and shipping in those cases. That's not suitable for every project, but it does mean we have, you know, individual people who can handle these things, which that's what the, you know, benefit of the co-op is. You know, there, a lot of times there is someone who can handle something like, oh yeah, I'm right down the street from this thing that would normally cost you twice as much.
Right.
So I know that's the case, Outliers, we had someone for that. So, you know, we've been trickling a bit more into the physical product space when we can. This is a smaller project, unless it gets bigger, which I'd love if it did. But if it does get bigger, we might see about doing, you know, a secondary offset print Kickstarter for it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this one's just to make sure everyone gets paid and the project gets made.
Right, right. How do projects generally come about in the Far Horizons model? Like, how, I mean, let's talk about this specifically instead of the theoretical. How did Guide to Mysterious Locations get started?
So, you know, imagine like a room with people in it, like, except digitally speaking, and then someone bursts through the door and goes, I've got an idea. And that is how most of our projects come along, except once they say that and they hear at least a few people say like, hey, that's a good idea, I'd love to be part of that. That person then has to settle down and write out the, you know, proposal is what we call it. It's usually, you know, a minor proposal for a book or a Kickstarter. You know, this is what it's going to be. This is how it's going to work. This is how the funding is going to be split up. This is the process for the Kickstarter. And, you know, everyone votes on that, you know, gives feedback if there is any, like, oh, you forgot to cover what happens if, you know, a missile strike hits you.
And then, I mean, I'm never gonna leave instructions on what to do if a missile hits me. You can figure that one out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's why I usually forget. Anyway, you know, once we have that set up, everyone votes on it. Almost always, you know, people vote to, you know, push the project forward because there's no reason not to. It's just there officially in case someone, you know, wanted to push something bad because we didn't realize that we had the wrong person in there, which, you know, that's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But we haven't had any problems like that yet, thankfully. So, you know, that gets voted on. Then we set up, you know, our little workspace in the work area of our co-op server, which... it does have a public space too, so that gets done. And then basically the person who proposed it usually takes on the lead, though we don't require them to. Someone else can come on as the lead and just talk with the person about the idea and help make things move forward. The lead gets a percentage of royalties just like any other role would. Not a huge one though, because again, it's about everyone involved contributing, not one person acting as the publisher and getting most of it. And then basically, the lead is responsible for making sure everyone moves forward with their parts. And with projects like this, where we have a lot of people on board, we usually have something like a Trello or another workspace where it's like, okay, here's what needs to get done. Here's your parts. Move it along when you've got it done. So I know when I can call on, like, once the writing's done, I call on the editors like, hey, this writing's done. Let's do that. And, you know, basically, move through the bottlenecks and get it ready for Kickstarter. So our project is nearly completed. You know, there's no worry this isn't going to get done. It's just making sure everyone gets something for their time, and we have something to make sure we can finish up the last few steps, maybe get some extra art.
Our extra art never hurts.
Yep. And of course, if we get through the different stretch goals, more locations, things like that.
Yeah, I like you have a stretch goal that I'm starting to see more and more that I really enjoy, which is everybody just gets paid more, which I think is great to have as a stretch goal and to point out is just like, yeah, we're just going to pay everybody more. It's great.
That first stretch goal is basically what we call our desired industry standard, which is, we go based on shares, but from the writer perspective, it's about 10 cents a word along with royalties from the sales after the Kickstarter. And then, you know, everything scales off of that. You know, we have a little less of that, mostly the royalties beforehand for the lower goals. But obviously we want something but rather than nothing if it's a slow campaign.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, gosh, it's we already covered it. It's wild. Everything is wild. Hey, everybody, it's 2025. It's wild. It's wild out here.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've looked outside. It's wild.
Mm-hmm.
So, Guide to Mysterious Locations. Like I said, I was looking through the preview, and I read all of. I mean, scroll back up here, because even though I just read it, the Homestead Community Center, which I really enjoyed. I've been reading Hell Followed With Us by Andrew Joseph White, and it is very in line with that in a very fun way. And I think the first thing I want to ask about Guide to Mysterious Locations is, and I guess the Guide to series in general, is what was kind of the impetus behind making it system agnostic or system neutral? Is it kind of a thinking that it can fit anywhere and it can be multiple things to multiple people? Is it sort of a desire from, you know, the idea that there are so many different Far Horizons, you know, titles, quote unquote, that, you know, it would seem silly to support one over the other?
Yeah, well, that's ultimately the thing. We have this system agnostic series because we want people to be able to write the ideas that they have. Like the Guide to X series tend to be, we have these disparate writers. They all have ideas about this general subject. We want to see what they come up with. We don't want to say, make it fit, you know, D&D or, you know, one of our own games like Little Gods or something. We want to say like, okay, write something. We'll make sure that it's malleable enough to fit all sorts of games. So, you know, it's really easy to make something like the Convoking Tower fit in, you know, your typical fantasy game. It's really easy to make Homestead Community Center fit into more modern horror type games like the X of Darkness games. I do want to mention the Homestead Community Center, which was mine, is something that I've been keeping it's the like it's the common thread that I've been keeping in all of the Guide to X books, because the Homestead Community Center in this one is the mysterious location, is a reference to the Heralds of the Void cult in the previous one. And in the heist book, there was a heist going into the community center to get a world-ending artifact, so they don't use it.
There was a reference in it of in the preview of something like a rival cult stole an item, and I was like, that feels like we're pointing at something. That feels like we're looking at something.
Yes, absolutely. So you know, if you want to read more about that, you know, the little story I've been creating with them, the timeline I've been creating, you got to buy all the books. I'm sorry. Be that way.
You get to buy all the books.
Yes, exactly. You get to buy all our books, our amazing books that you want to buy anyway. Coming back to it, it all comes down to, like, we all have our own separate ideas about the coolest things we want to write about in these general subject matters, and we want to make sure that fits as many games as possible, and that as many games as possible fits our ideas, just to make sure we can all do what we want.
Yeah, and I've been coming around on system agnostic stuff. I think I've said it on the podcast that you know, I thought it was silly or something like that, and I think the more that I've looked at them, the more that I've read, the more that I've kind of understood the goals with them, I've come around on them. It makes it, and you know, my opinion was an uneducated one. I was just like, well, this seems silly, you should write it for a thing. And then I just sort of I read a couple and I went, oh, I see why this is beneficial. I see why people do this now.
Yeah, and so like I will say one thing about, you know, the system agnostic stuff is, if you're too complete with it, like you do a complete like campaign setting and world, that can be harder to fit to anything and everything, because, you know, ultimately, if you're defining things about like, okay, this is exactly how magic works, then suddenly anything with a different magic system doesn't work. And I understand the, you know, trepidation about that kind of thing, which is why, you know, what we do is actually perfect for that, because it's like, okay, whatever does work for your setting, pick and choose from this list we have that doesn't have to be interconnected. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have to have the book bar in the same game that you have the Mitanni Mart in. It, you know, it gets around the usual issue with system agnostic stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting about the guide specifically is they're focused on a general theme. You know, mm-hmm. If you're looking for cults, if you're looking for heists, if you're looking for weird places, okay, cool. You know, those are going to fit in a lot of different games. Right. Just on the face of it, it kind of doesn't matter. If you're playing, like you said, any of the World of Darkness games, you could be playing Urban Shadows, you could be playing and listen, if anybody's out there still playing Dresden TTRPG, shout outs to you.
Oh man.
Yeah, like honestly, yeah. If somebody's still playing that, good on you. Love you. Right. Write in. You know, it wouldn't even be that difficult to adopt something like this for to take some threads for something like even like Monster Hearts of just like, yeah, this is just like some weird vibes that you get at the regular community center, right? You could very easily take this and shift it that way. And that's,
oh yeah,
that's,
absolutely.
Like you mentioned, I think the system neutral stuff that I've seen before has tried to be too specific while being too neutral, you know, of like, this is exactly how it is, but it's not D&D, I promise. I think that's half of it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, it's like, it's know. System neutral, and they just mean it's just not, we didn't want to put the D&D branding on it.
Right. And you know, that's the other thing. A lot of times system neutral stuff's like, okay, this is clearly built for a specific system. Mm-hmm. Don't be a coward. But
yeah, that was, I think that was a thing that I said where I was like, if you're building a thing, and you're all you're doing is filing the numbers off of it, I'm like, just go for it. Just say it's for the thing, and you right. know, go for it. Go do the thing that it feels clear that you want to do.
Yeah, and like I will say, a lot of the ones that I've contributed to this, like, they fit well into my own games, which, you know, aren't, you know, separate from the co-op. Like my game, The Blood, which is about vampires and magic, to you know, not go too into it. And like, so the things like the community center, it's really easy to fit in because it's, you know, magic, modern, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The On Aeroscape is another one I'm doing that's not on the project page. So, you know, unique reference for you. The On Aeroscape is basically a dream world that people who are away from home tend to visit when they're dreaming. You know, the whole thing is like, if you're uncomfortable, you end up coming together with other people in the stream. And then who knows what the heck's going on there. Mm-hmm. You know, I won't get too into it because we don't want to reveal everything straight away. But
yeah, you got to pay to find out.
Right.
If you want to hear about this one, go back the Kickstarter.
Yeah, pretty much. But, you know, so the thing is, like, you know, a lot of us have like a general type of setting we're thinking of when we make it, but we also, you know to make it exactly how we want. And, you know, it's the onus is on the user to make sure, make the tiny tweaks you might need to make it fit whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And they all work out pretty well for that, I think.
Yeah. And so you talked at the top about, you know, you have your own sort of publishing imprint. You have, you know, you have your own sort of focus on stuff. Is that common amongst people in Far Horizons? Is that uncommon?
Oh, yeah, it's very common. A lot of us have our own small thing. Like, some people put more into it than others. Some people will just release a game on itch when it comes to them. It's mostly text. And then other people will have full games that they did on their own on Kickstarter that have layout and art and everything. But the thing is, you know, everyone has, not everyone, but a lot of people have some amount of experience on their own. You know, it's a very diverse group of people. You know, both in the literal definition of that and in the amount of experience and individuality we have in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But funny we go into that because, you know, one of the tiers is a bundle of different games from the contributors to this one.
Well, that's nice. Hey, you need a game to run some of this stuff in. Hey, guess what?
Exactly. And on that note, you know, everyone, the games we contributed are all in the general thematic of this book too. You know, they all have something to do with weird places and whatnot on some level. Like the game I contributed, Paved in Blood, which is itself a setting creation game where you create a weird conspiracy filled city, is obviously based on locations first and foremost. So this is great for inspiration for that kind of thing. We have other games in it, like, shoot, the name's escaping me at this exact moment. I can find it in just a moment.
The fun of, oh, let me remember that. Oh, no, hang on.
Yeah. Ghost Box is the one by Marks, and that's a pretty unique game that they've been slowly working on for a while at this point. I think the original version of it hit itch like years back, but they recently started working on it. You know, it was originally an Ashcan edition, but, you know, their game is like a solo exploring type game. That's talking about letters that you leave and find in abandoned post boxes over the course of years. So it's its own weird little place type thing, you know, centering on those post boxes.
Mm-hmm. So the benefit of all that experience has to be really helpful on a project like this that has, you know, maybe not so many completely different things, but asking for different vibes, different themes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We all have like our favorite genres and the different types of books we've worked on. So, you know, we make sure that everyone has their favorite thing to work on and they all have experience in that. So we get the like best of the best for these, you know, individual things that then come together to a greater whole. And mm-hmm. That's what's great about this type of project.
It's an interesting thing working on a project like this because I've noticed it feels like some publishers are kind of building a niche for their specific products. You know, Evil Hat always does this sort of game and whatever. Is there ever a feeling of with Far Horizons with this sounds like a leading question. I don't mean it to be. Is there ever anything of people's personal projects becoming a Far Horizon work? Has there been anything that's made that jump?
Oh yeah, a lot of people get involved because, like, okay, they're like, I have no idea how to how to navigate the industry. How do I get editors and artists? And, you know, we just sidle up like, hey, seems like you need a crew.
Seems like you're looking for an editor.
Right. And, you know, we've got people on, you know, all the whole line of, you know, layout, editing, writing. So, you know, if someone is just a writer, you know, just an editor or something like that, like, okay, I really want my project made. Can you help me out? We'll help them out. And it works the same as any other project. You know, we explain to them our process, and it's as simple as them making the write-up. And that's, I mentioned how sometimes we have one of our own, you know, take on the lead of a project that's new just because someone doesn't know how it works yet. That's the time it's most likely, but sometimes people figure out how to step into the boots of it right away, which is great. So yeah, we have both internal projects and ones that come from someone else just seeking out help.
That's great. That's a thing that's come up a couple times on the podcast is the sort of importance of community building, but in a way that's kind of difficult to describe in what is inherently like a business sense. But sort of passing on and building that institutional knowledge, you know, of like, here's how these processes generally work. Here's how you do this, this, and this, you know?
Right.
And sort of the ways that, how do I want to phrase this? The ways that like democratizing that knowledge and spreading it to people outside of people inside of your business umbrella sort of benefits everyone overall. You know, when I had Andy on, I think it came up when I had Riley on, you know, talking about working with other people, helping them build up their knowledge base, helping them build up their own, you know, build their own processes. And then just like, okay, now you're doing your own thing. Like, this wasn't a business relationship. This was, I want to help you get your stuff done.
Right.
And then everybody sails off in their own way.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like, a lot of times, you know, people will continue off on their own things, but a lot of times they'll also, you know, join up, and then they can help pass that knowledge on to others. You know, it's like the distributed computing of tabletop industry. You know, the more people we get, the more likely it is that we'll be able to get any given project done quickly and easily, which is great. You know, the drawback of a huge group is, of course, you know, that many people, decision making can be hard, but you know, we have it set up so, you know, eventually you can just call the vote and anyone who's paying attention can vote and that's the end of it. So we try to pull back the drawbacks while focusing in on the benefit of having that collective knowledge and helping people out and, you know, just getting everything out there. And it's been working out really well so far, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's one of those things where as long as you're understanding what the negatives or drawbacks you could be experiencing are, and you sort of recognize them and say, hey, like these are the common pitfalls in a model like this. How do we identify them and minimize them as much as possible, or you know, make sure that three people can't decide that they're going to block every project because they want to be jerks about it.
Yeah, exactly. You got to make sure to cover all those. And, you know, early on we had some growing pains and we had to figure out all these things like, okay, how do we make these processes the least painful as possible? And, you know, that's a recommendation I have for anyone else going the co-op route is to make sure you know how it's going to work as you're going into it, which sounds simple and obvious, but not everyone thinks about how they're going to do things as they go into it, so they need the reminder.
That is a thing that's come up as well of just like, oh, I'm gonna do this. How? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Ooh, that's a good question. How?
Right.
So how does scoping something like Guide to Mysterious Locations look like? You know, are you trying to hit a page count? Are you trying to hit a number of locations?
So with a project like Mysterious Locations, we usually know at the beginning, like, okay, this is a big enough project. We want to make sure people get paid ahead of time. Because sometimes for small projects, we'll just release it and do royalty based and everyone's happy with that because it's a small project. It took them all an afternoon. But, you know, a large one like this, we know it's going to Kickstarter. So we have to think, okay, what's the budget going to be? What do we want people to get for this amount of work? So we went into this knowing like, okay, we did like a fake budget, figuring out how many locations and things like that we can put into it. And so once we figured out, like, okay, the ideal we want is the honestly the first stretch goal, the 8,000. But we did a smaller one because we figured, like, okay, we know how things are right now. Let's be sure we get something out of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we figured out the 8,000 and we figured out, like, okay, that means we can do this many locations, you know, with the cost of each location. Since because they're all pretty much the same in, like, they have X amount of word count editing, they all get this many images and so on. We can figure out how much each one costs. And then we, you know, just did the math. And so we landed at 10 and then, you know, possibly more than that. If the budget goes up.
Yeah, it's got to be such an interesting thing working in, you know, the age of the Kickstarter now, working on a project like this, of how, you know, determining that initial budget, determining what, you know, what's the real number, what's the nice to have number, what's the we get this, we can do X and Y number. Especially in you know, I've talked to a bunch of people about this, the way that in the rare instance where I will not name names, in the way that it seems like a lot of larger companies use Kickstarters as just glorified pre-order systems. As actually a great example we can talk about in a very real way, Cool Mini or Not has been having a really big collapse with a lot of the, you know, tariff and trade stuff going on. And that was a model that I always felt was a way they were paying themselves forward. You know, they were having a new Kickstarter to pay off everything for the last Kickstarter that they could keep momentum moving.
Yeah, we've had that kind of issue in the past where you know, the money can't do what it needs to if you do the Kickstarter first, which is why we're, like, you know, like 75-80% of the way through the project before we put up the Kickstarters these days. Because we just want to make sure, like, okay, this is almost done. We're getting people their money almost as soon as the Kickstarter money comes in, like maybe a little longer as we polish things up. But, you know, everything's going to be paid for. Everything's going to be at the price that it is as we, you know, start calculating it. So, you know, that's what I've been doing, you know, for myself lately too, with my personal Kickstarters, is like, okay, make sure I'm almost done before I do the budget.
Yeah.
Of course that has its own issues of being sure that you have the time and money to get that done before you have the Kickstarter, but, you know, there's always something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's no absolutely perfect model. It's just what works for you. But it's interesting to see the way, I don't want to say the way the market's changed. That makes me sound too smart and full of myself. that makes it sound like when Kickstarter started, I was paying attention to what was happening, and I absolutely wasn't. I was just like, oh, this seems cool.
Right.
But I've heard from a number of people that have gotten into doing TTRPGs since Kickstarter being a thing, and the way that has become the de facto. The way that you launch a product is you go to Kickstarter. You know, very, very few RPGs, unless they're small itch things, which, you know, right. thank God there, some people will still just make PDFs for things. Here's my Kickstarter. And not in a way that's disparaging anybody. Don't take that as me pooing on anybody or as a negative. It's just, there's a certain amount of frustration to see so much of the industry tied up in one specific company.
Right. I get what you're saying. It's like, it sucks that it's the state of the industry rather than it being a problem of the publishers themselves.
Right. Right. Everybody that's doing it are people who are trying to get their products made and exist in this ecosystem. And it sucks that this is the ecosystem that exists.
Yeah. We've been caught in the trap. It's what's there. Mm-hmm. You know, as I mentioned, we do have smaller projects where we don't bother with the Kickstarter. We just give everyone royalties. We have our Thousand Burning Stars, which is they're smaller games where basically you have one person at each role, you know, one author, one editor, one illustrator, get it done, get it out there. And, you know, those come out as mostly just royalty based, like I was mentioning before. Mm-hmm. You know, so we make sure we cover the gamut. We don't want to completely tie ourselves to Kickstarter.
Right. And it's been interesting to see. I feel like it's just happened over the last couple months. It's been interesting to see Backerkit mainly try to rest. I don't want to say rest control. That sounds like a big deal. Try to make BackerKit more attractive and more appealing to tabletop projects specifically. In a way that like has been interesting to see. And I worry that in some ways it's just trading one bad for another, but I do feel like, from people that I've heard talk about it, people at BackerKit are really interested in working with people, and they have done BackerKit specifically has done what seems like a lot of changes and initiatives to build, you know, build around the tabletop industry and try to facilitate that.
Right.
You know, they had Mothership Month not that long ago, which seemed like an interesting idea. I'm not going to say a good idea because I haven't heard one way or another from people involved. So I won't say I can't, you know, put a idea on it. And then they're coming up with Mouse Rider Month in November, I believe. And it's an interesting concept to build these smaller projects around a bigger project in a way that you can kind of only do on that sort of website, in a way that Kickstarter has never really like tried to do.
We were considering BackerKit. The main thing is that because, like, especially with me as lead, a lot of my projects are smaller. A lot of what actually comes in tends to be from, you know, the Kickstarter front end or back end, you know, people our bigger backer source, biggest backer source, say that five times fast, is the previous project email. Like, oh, someone, you know, you've previously backed is doing a new one. That's where the majority, well, the highest percent of our pledges have come from. So, you know, we're all nervous about switching, but it will probably happen at some point.
It's an interesting idea, but, you know, like I said, I don't want to say that it's good because without, you know, to say on whether or not it would be good, you would have to talk to everybody involved about how they felt about the project, what ultimately they made, all of that. And, you know, that's that's a large undertaking.
You need the behind the scenes on that. I get you.
Yeah. Guides to Mysterious Locations is set up specifically with the framing of here's a location, here's what's been going on, here's some hooks and threads and things that you can build off of.
We have a specific like layout for each of these where you have the first page of everyone is like the, you know, the main art of it. You know, we have a set of three absolutely amazing artists who have completely different styles, and they all work for this because of the way this book works. That's another great thing. Like, there are some books where if the art differs, you know, you look at it and you go, this is the same game and you're giving me different art, it's taking me out of the moment. But in a case like this, because everything is so different, you know, innately it doesn't hit you when you're going to a completely different location and have a new style there. You know, we have you know, Bree Dedanen has like a more like I don't want to say cartoonish, but like, you know, line and color based style. And like, she did the Containment Store, for instance, and that looks amazing. And then we have Carly AF, who has more of a like charcoal on paper style, like, you know, black forward instead of white forward. And that is its own thing, and it looks absolutely amazing. Like, the Homestead Community Center art is such an obvious example of how that's the perfect style for it. And so we have those first, and then, you know, that visual sits above the kind of like the GM intro to the place. Like, this is the kind of thing, like, if someone looks this place up in game, the GM could basically pull this page up and say, you know, read that off. And it, you know, we write it like that to kind of get you right into the moment and make you interested in the same way that a player would be interested hearing about it. Then we go into kind of like the GM side description of it, you know, the on the surface section that goes into what it looks like, what people would know hearing about it in game, what most people think of it. Then we go into the magical, supernatural, or otherwise odd effect that it has on things. And it might be something like staying there freaks you out or changes you, or it might be that there's like hidden deals to be made there. Anything like that. That's the it's the thing that makes it a mysterious location. And then further into the GM only rabbit hole, not even necessarily GM only, but we have the cause, which is like, okay, why is this the case from a setting perspective? And that can be changed easily. That's the most often point where we have like the alteration sidebars, where it'll go into like, okay, maybe this isn't caused by this, it's caused by this. Like, you know, the Convoking Tower is a very clearly fantasy place, but then we have a sidebar about like, okay, how does this work in sci-fi? And it's like the example there is like, okay, this is actually, instead of being some other realm, it's you know, the first example of teleportation technology, and you know, bringing these things from another planet forward, as an example. And then of course we cap it off with obvious story hooks, like this is the these are easy ways to just hook this right into your game, pick one of these, go. You know, you're all set.
I always wonder, like, how much editing, how much work, how much shaping does it take to take these you know, these prompts, these dossiers, whatever you want to call them, and fit them into these pages? You know, I imagine, like we talked about, you know, you budget this many pages, this many locations, this much
right.
space. How much inevitably gets left on the cutting room floor?
Oh yeah, there's always something on the floor. So like, you know, as we're doing that budgeting thing, I also have to come up with like the outline, like, okay, this is how many words probably can cover everything we want each of these locations to cover. You know, the lead is generally in charge of how the page is going to look, like how everything's going to be organized. And then that goes into figuring out the budget. There's always, once I have that figured out, that's when I generally start bringing on other people, like the actual writers and editors and stuff. And it's like, okay, give us your pitches, let's get as many cool ideas into this as we can. And I go and I pick the most diverse ones, but there's always, you know, people will pitch like 3 to 5 ideas each, and they'll each get like 1 to 2 depending on, you know, our budget. So there's always something left behind, something that someone's dying to write, and so, you know, some reason to help us get to our stretch goals.
Yeah, listen, you always want something left over for mysterious locations too. You know, you never want to run through all your good ideas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The question that's always fun and interesting to ask in a thing like this, and I think this is going to be a weird answer, you know, for something like Far Horizons, is what's next? What's on? No, I'm not gonna say what's on the horizon. I didn't say it. Don't act like I said it. But with this sort of setup, with this, you know, the sort of construction, like, how many projects do you generally have in, you know, in production, big air quotes, at a time?
I know we have another 1,000 Burning Stars project going right now. I would have to double check which one is currently on the board, so to speak. We have another project that will probably, we had a Kickstarter that didn't manage to get through, that we were originally calling the Guide to Death. And that's being changed into a completely different sort of project, because we realized part of it was it didn't completely fit the layout we have to the Guide to X ones. We have someone working on that. It's going to be basically games predicated around death, as well as basically being like therapy for processing it too, when possible. You know, we have some talented people who are planning to, you know, make sure all that can fit together and be everything it can be, instead of just like throwing death in your face. What else do we have going on right now? Oh, we have a project called we have a project called Petmon that someone's working on, and that's basically an homage to Digimon type stuff, with its own quirks, you know, digital fighters, another world that they exist in. It's going to have systems for making your own, things like that. So, you know, overall, we have a lot going on at any given time, and there's always considerations for new things. Like when I led Paranormal Freelancing, that all came and went in the course of, I want to say, like 4 months. I pitched it. I was like, who wants to do a sprint, get this thing out there, and get a project under our belt? And we did it. We got it out in like 4 months. So anything like that could spring up at any moment, too. We have so many people and so many, you know, so much bandwidth because of those people. Mm-hmm. you know, a lot can come out. And we're really happy about that.
You said at the top that it functions essentially like someone burst in the room with a good idea. Is that is that, you know, is that most projects just, hey, I've got a cool idea, who wants to work on it? And then, you know, it rushes off.
So the Thousand Burning Stars series is something that we have kind of a queue for. People are putting things into it. It's its own series. It gets its own like type of advertising. It's basically what replaced our Short Games Digest, because we wanted to put more into a single game instead of like splitting it between 10 games that people will play once each. And so that is, you know, more typical, get it figured out, put it in a queue, figure out when it's going to happen. It, you know, it has its own schedule. That's more like typical. But beyond that, most of it comes down to just whenever someone has an idea. We do have some amount of scheduling in terms of like, we make sure Kickstarters are not going to overlap. We don't want three Far Horizons Kickstarters going at once, obviously, because sure. That would, you know, split the focus in a bad way.
It's got to be a really interesting thing to be a part of, is to, you know, watch all of these, especially, you know, as a project lead or something, seeing all of these bits come through and you know, help them along. And it sounds exciting to have all of these different things, you know, going at the same time.
Like even on the same project, I love seeing the disparate parts coming together. And then like, we'll see like, you know, another project just got released and it's like a completely different thing that I can look at. And it's, you know, it's really nice to just see the completely different array of things coming from the one group, from all of us working together like this.
Yeah, I wonder what I mentioned earlier. I wonder what cool things Far Horizons put out that people might not even be aware. There's always benefit to digging back through and seeing this is a thing I've said for a while. There's always a benefit to seeing, you know, look into everybody who worked on the thing that you liked and go see what you might have missed, see what they worked on. You know, you might find your new favorite game.
Right. And like, yeah, that's the thing. We have projects of completely different scope and popularity. So, you know, if you are, you know, a Brinkwood player or something, that's one of our most popular games, obviously, you know, go back in and look through and check out, you know, We Dig Giant Robots is a smaller one, or Paranormal Freelancing, like I just mentioned. You know, if you like Outliers, check out the Thousand Burning Stars stuff. They tend to be the same sort of, you know, creative scope. And you know, there's a lot there. I'd like to think we have something for everyone.
Yeah, with all of the short games that you've already done, all of the collections, and then all of the new shorter stuff, and it was really, like I said, it was really interesting going through, looking at the whole catalog and being like, holy cow, like this, not only are there, like I said, there was stuff in there that I didn't even realize was, you know, worked on by the same people, but even just different themes, different genres, different styles.
Yeah. And like, you know, there's benefits to focus, but there's also benefits to just having, you know, so much out there.
Mm-hmm. Let's dig into homework. This is the part of the show. Don't tell anybody. This is my favorite part of the show. Because if you don't know, if this is somehow your first time listening, homework is the part of the show where I ask the guest to bring in cool stuff to tell you about, in the same way that the podcast is, you know, me telling you about something cool, me getting somebody on to talk about all the cool stuff they do. The guest has to tell you about cool stuff that they like. So Chris brought a couple things to tell us about. What do you got?
All right. One thing I want to mention is Machine Age Games, the publisher by Olivia Hill. They're the publisher of iHunt, you know, the tabletop RPG and the novel series. And they then recently put out on YouTube a little short for iHunt, like, you know, a video, like what, you know, a pitch for a series kind of thing. And I watched it and it is absolutely wonderful. You know, it's low budget in a way that makes it look like it's supposed to be low budget, and it's perfect. And there are some great lines in there that just like get me every time. I don't want to spoil them, obviously, because I think you should go watch it. I also wanted to mention, I didn't know ahead of time we were going to go so far into everything does. But I wanted to, a project I'm not involved in Far Horizons is Little Gods. I wanted to bring some, you know, eyes on that.
Oh, it's, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really cool game where like a bunch of people play like these little spirits, and one person, rather than being a typical GM, plays a traveler who interacts with them. It has a unique sort of character creation and, you know, a lot of cool little things. So check that out.
Yeah.
And then another thing away from our own stuff, you know, perverse, like some derivation of the compliment sandwich, I don't know, is a game I've been playing, an indie video game that's based on Pathfinder 2e called Dawnsbury Days. They're a really small game with like some dedicated modders, and of course the publisher themselves is Dawnsbury Studios. It's perfect. I've been playing that lately. It's a really nice homage to the Pathfinder second edition system, first game that actually used it. It's a tiny little tile based thing, but there's like so much heart in it, and it does the system so well. So if you like that, check Dawnsbury Days out, you know, give them some love. They need it.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. I was really bummed when Owlcat said they weren't going to do any Pathfinder 2e games.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I guess it's working out for him, and that's great. But it was definitely a little bit like, oh, okay, guys. Like, all right.
Yeah, maybe they'll change their mind after they're done with 40K, which is, you know, what they're doing now. Dark Heresy, I think, is the next one that's coming.
Well, so they
don't get me wrong, I'm looking forward to that too.
Yeah, they have Dark Heresy, and they're doing an Expanse game.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are. Owlcat does wonderful games a year after they release each game.
You know what? You're not wrong. That's not incorrect.
Don't get me wrong. I buy them day one, but
No, that's the thing I always say for like, especially for, because I always say don't buy games new because they're rarely worth the price. Indie games asterisk, but almost any video game, buy it and then play it 6 months later.
Yeah, absolutely. That's generally my thing with that. Like Owlcat, I do sometimes buy day one just because they're like subjects I'm really excited about. Like, you know, Rogue Trader was like, I bought day one even though it was a buggy mess just because I wanted to play a Rogue Trader game so much. But yeah, Dawnsbury Days is more based on the combat, but it has little story quips in between and little systems for making sure you get to use all of your skills. So it's really great, and they're slowly building the level cap up. And it's really moddable, as I implied. I think that covers what I actually had prepared.
That was good. That was a good quick. I've had some people ask like I had Grant Getz on, and I was like, all right, you know, I gave him the spiel. I was like, okay, 3 to 5 things, and he's like, I have 15, and I was like, I mean, if you want to do 15, if you want to sit here and talk about 15 things, let's go, you know.
This is cheating, but everyone involved in our projects, check out their individual things because all of them are cool.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that was so I'll leave this in just so, because this will be part of the discussion. When I message the guests to tell them about homework, whatever, I always say 3 to 5 things that you like, whatever has been interesting to you lately. And I always say I'd prefer it if it wasn't something that you worked on, and I you know, told Chris specifically, you know, but, you know, working as part of a co-op, it can be whatever. But yeah, it's very few instances that somebody, you know, quote unquote, things you haven't worked on, it involves this many people, this many projects, right? It's usually right. Like, yeah, don't tell me about the other game that you worked on with somebody. Like we probably know about it. We've probably already talked about it. So it's, yeah. Homework is a fun, interesting kettle of fish sometimes.
Yeah, I like it. I really like it. It's a good idea for your podcast. Make sure that, you know, it's not just the one person's things, you know, spread the love, give people something else to spread out into, see what the, you know, and it tells you something about us as well. Like, you know, what do we like, you know, what kind of things are we into?
Right. It's always just an interesting little peek of like, here's what the inspiration is, because I'm all, you know, it came about partially a podcast I was on, like asked me for it directly and was just like have a thing that we're going to talk. You know, have a thing that we'll talk about near the end of the podcast. And I was like, this is a great idea. I should use it. But what really solidified it for me was when I had Banana Chan on, and they made a joke about like about reading some book, and I just offhandedly was like, oh, what are you reading, what are you talking about? And then we spent like 25 minutes talking about all the books they're reading, and I was like, this is great. I'm like, this is we should just do this. Right. This should just be part of the podcast.
Yeah, on the subject of novels, I don't read a ton of them, but you know, one of them was like a spinoff of the I Hunt universe, so you know, it's one of the few things that actually can capture my attention. It's the vampire book in the I Hunt universe. Shoot, what's it called?
I Fang. It's probably not that.
No, it's not that. I cannot remember what the book's called. Sorry.
It's fine. It's fine.
But you know, look up I Hunt, you'll find it among there.
Yeah, yeah. I will figure out what it is. This is a great place to say because I haven't said it yet. Everything will be in the show notes. Everything we talk about will get linked in the show notes. So future me, good luck figuring out what book we're talking about. It's probably not that right. difficult based on context.
Right.
Sometimes it's really fun where it's just like, what are we talking? What the hell? And I gotta spend a little time. It's okay, it's part of the process.
Yeah, there's this one thing I read in third grade. It had words in it.
You know, yeah, I read this book about a tree, and it's like, oh, I probably won't. So this is the last question. This is the last question. First, Chris, before we get too far from it, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is always, you know, I always say it is fantastic to have people on the show talk about all the cool stuff. I'm really excited to check out Guide to Mysterious Locations. The Kickstarter page will be linked in the show notes. You can go check it out. You can download the preview that will be linked in the that's linked on the Kickstarter page. You should go check it out. You can read two of the locations and go see how you feel about it. I really enjoyed it. And I'll say they have a really nicely affordable PDF tier. So if you're interested and you're unsure if you want to take the plunge for a physical version, they have a really nicely priced PDF tier that I think would do well in a lot of people's collections.
Oh, that's one thing I really wanted to talk about really quick.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we have a couple of things to make sure that people who can't easily afford it can. We have both the hardship tier, the traveler tier, the first tier for PDF only, you know, a bit cheaper. You know, no means testing. If you think you are on that tier, take that tier. Mm-hmm. And then we also have add-ons for community copies, where if you add those on, we will give you know, free copies of the PDF out to other people who simply can't afford it, period, at the end.
That's always nice.
So, you know, you buy one version of the PDF, two people get it.
That's always nice. That's always a nice thing to do if you have the ability to add on and add extra community copies. That's great. That's a great option to have.
Yep.
I've seen we're not going to get into it. I've seen discourse around community copies. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't want to weigh into it. I don't know. It seems good. I don't know. This is the worst way to talk about discourse, is to just say it and then be like, we're not going to talk about it.
Yep, discourse exists.
Yeah, I saw discourse. We're not going to get into it, but we're not even discoursing. What am I doing? So the final question, three question, this is essentially a joke that I made for myself. This is a bit that I looped myself into. My first episode, I asked my guest, the Amazing Star, what three guests she would love to have on her podcast, which is what we were interviewing about. And ever since then, I've always asked the guest what their favorite three blanks are. And it's just a silly way to close out the podcast. I come up with it over the course of the episode, so even I don't know what it's going to be. This is a funny one. This is a funny one. Okay, I'm gonna bet. How much of a World of Darkness nerd are you?
Pretty, yeah.
Okay. I will say I'm a zero, but I feel like this question will hit somebody who's a nerd. Chris, what are your three favorite Vampire the Masquerade books?
Oh, three favorite books. That's a good question. So I will say I'm more of a 20th anniversary edition person there than a 5th edition. So
I'm a Shadowrun as a Shadowrun fan. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I also prefer the anniversary edition versus the fourth edition. It's funny how that worked out.
Right. So you know, my favorite book's probably the Blood Sorcery book for a V20 called something.
How would the Blood Sorcery book not be your favorite? That's fair.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm always the person who, when I play a vampire, try to, you know, be a mage too. So, rites of blood, that's it. So that's definitely one of my favorite World of Darkness books. There's the Mage Familiar book. Did you say vampire or all of World of Darkness?
It could be all of them. Go for it.
Okay.
Sorry. Liz, if there's one that pulls your fancy, you know, don't let me stop you.
There's the Forged in Dragonfire Mage book, which was like revised, which was all about, it was both familiars and how to create all sorts of magical items. And then what was my third book? Kind of thing where if I don't remember it right this moment, I'm going to hit myself later. Like, really? You didn't think of that? It would probably be the Sorcerer book. Would be my other favorite. You know, it's the one that's like for linear magic for mortals that you can put into basically any game instead of just mage. I always loved taking bits of sorcery in any other game, you know, playing a kinfolk who knows magic, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So the favorites are the sorcery book, the familiar book, the blood sorcery book, excuse me, the familiar book, and then the regular sorcery book.
Yep.
Okay, good.
Can you find a theme there?
I just wanted to make, you know, it's one of those things. Sometimes you just have to point out and you go like, this is correct. Okay, good. Just want to make sure everybody's on the same page.
Yep.
Listen, I can't lie. I would be into the blood sorcery book too. That is the thing. That'd be the thing. I'd be like, what's in this book? Tell me about this one. What do you got here?
Like, I mean, I've always been, you know, in any game I play, if there's a magic system, I'm using the magic system. And then if there's an option for vampires, I'm also doing that. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I'm actually, you know. I'm surprised I never played a mage in Shadowrun. Of, you know, of the handful of times I played. Yeah, as somebody who also like plays a lot of magic users and things very kind of pointedly, I play a Decker generally, and I guess that's a different sort of magic.
Yeah, in its way. I've only played a little bit of Shadowrun. I played I did play a mage, obviously, but I also played one time I played a Technomancer, which is like kind of, you know, it was the magic version of the Decker that they made who could also go into the net.
Mm-hmm.
But both of those games were brief, so I can't tell you much.
Shadowrun's a weird game. Shadowrun's a weird game. The thing I would say with Shadowrun is Shadowrun's a great game if you played in any system other than Shadowrun. That's why there's, right. That's why there's so many. Yeah,
an amazing setting. Mm-hmm. And then like, I've actually, I've been playing Cities Without Number with a few friends of mine in a very Shadowrun like, you know, setting. I've been playing a summoner in that one.
Oh, see, that sounds nice.
That's something in that system. And it's a lot of fun. You know, instead of having to have a spell list, you figure out what you can summon that can do what you want.
Mm-hmm. That's usually why playing in a different system is more enjoyable, is you can kind of pick and choose the bits that you want to engage with.
Yeah.
You don't have to pretend that like the hacking rules don't exist and you hand wave them. You can just say, you just do it. It's fine.
Right.
You know, I have a, I think this is the first time I've mentioned this on the podcast. I have a cyberpunk setting that I'm working on. And when I say setting, cool. I mean like a shared world I want to use for games that I run, not like a thing that I want to write and publish. You know, I want to be, gotcha, I want to be even more pushes glasses up annoying about it. the thing that came up when I was looking at all of the Far Horizon stuff is I actually have Eldritch Care Unit in my list of weird games to run in my cyberpunk setting.
Oh nice. Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah, because I was like, what if we ran ER, but it's in the Shadowrun setting? That's
yeah,
fun.
It would honestly be perfect for that, given the themes of any cyberpunk. Mm-hmm. You know, just, you know, instead of it just being magic stuff, you have to figure out the weird technological things that go into it too, which honestly sounds amazing to me.
Yeah, it's a weird.
Let me know how that goes if you do that.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those I'm biting off more than I can chew. Absolutely, and we'll see. Mm-hmm. We'll see how the whole thing goes.
Yeah. Eldritch Care Unit was the first, you know, game I published for myself.
It's really interesting. It's a great example of one of my sort of like core ideas of TTRPGs, of like games that are very focused on telling a specific story.
Yeah.
And just like, this is what it is. It is this thing. You are these people doing this thing. And I'm starting to grow to just really adore systems that are that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, thankfully there's 1,000 of them and they all tell 1,000 different stories and you're set. Boom. Right. Done.
That is definitely the advantage of the current state of the industry. You can find something specific for whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't exist, you know, maybe make it. Who knows?
You know, yeah, there you go.
Maybe. Maybe call up Far Horizons. You bust in the digital room. You say, I've got an idea.
Yeah, and we'll be there.
That's, you know what? That's a great place to leave it. We found a nice little button for it. Chris, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yep. And thanks again for having me.
Yeah. That's the end. Go ahead. Say bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
I want to thank Chris so much for making time to sit down and chat with me. I always appreciate that people take time out of their very busy schedules doing Kickstarters and all of this to be on the podcast and listen to my silly questions. I honestly didn't think it was going to be all of this when I started doing this, and I have nothing but the guests to thank for that, and you, the listener. As I said at the beginning, Far Horizons is currently on Kickstarter, so go ahead. Go check it out. Back it if you're curious. See what else Far Horizon has worked on. I definitely want to go through all of the old short game collections, like I mentioned, and read Eldritch Care Squad for my Cyberpunk game, which I guess I talked about in a public setting. Gosh, that's the first time I've really talked about it to anyone. I hope you're excited for an absolutely packed September. I have a good handful of episodes that I'm going to work through and release for September so that I can get my plate completely cleared and try to get on a more consistent release schedule and a quicker turnaround for doing interviews. I let it get away from me a little bit. You know, I have my stream, I have my life, all of that, all of these things piled up in a really unfun way. So if you're enjoying the podcast, look forward to a lot of new episodes this month. If you are enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate if you rated the show wherever you listen to it, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, any other. I'm not familiar with any of the other platforms. I've been using Pocket Casts for so long. I did see someone gave us 5 stars on Pocket Cast, so thank you so much, whoever you are. But also, tell your friends. That's also just as effective and maybe more interesting to talk to your friends instead of just putting a number into a machine. If you've got a little extra money in your pocket, I would absolutely appreciate your support on Patreon. Helps pay for the hosting and all of that stuff for running the show. You've got completely ad-free listening for the audio and the video episodes, and you get fun little outtake clips whenever they happen. And of course, no outro would be complete without talking about my good friends over at +1 EXP. I'm actually really lucky that since talking to Tony and, you know, him giving us the discount code for the podcast and all of that, I've gotten to interact with and, you know, be friends and be cool with more of the people that do work at and with +1 EXP. And that's just so amazing. I've been very, very lucky with all of the amazing people that I've been able to meet and do stuff with. Specifically at +1 EXP. So shout outs to them. Like, this is not for nothing. This isn't like they paid me to do this discount code. Tony and I are just cool. And he said one day, hey, what if I gave you a discount code? And I was like, that would be amazing. Thank you so much. So if you enjoy what they do, if you enjoy what we do, let's hook it up. You can use code WDPodcast over at the +1 EXP store for 10% off your order of any game, physical or digital, which, you know, is a pretty solid deal. But also, if you haven't signed up for Zine Club yet, I highly recommend it. Zine Club is amazing. I love getting the Zine Club email every month, packed full of new, exciting, interesting, and sometimes exclusive games. If that sounds good to you, you can use the same code, WDPodcast, to get 10% off your first month. Now, Zine Club is already very, very affordable, but listen, who doesn't like a little discount? Again, code WDPodcast, 10% off your first month of Zine Club or anything in the store. But that's enough out of me. Thank you again so much for listening. I hope wherever you are, you're happy, healthy, safe, and I'll see you in the next one.